Hello and welcome back to The Unsafe Space, which is a podcast where I, Sarah Ryan, attempt to do what everybody on Twitter wants to do and take strips off Keith Redmond and his loose political views.
And I'm Keith Redmond, the aforementioned, who is at this podcast to try and teach Sarah Ryan the ways of the ninja and make her realise that I have great wisdom. And you're very welcome to this second podcast. Just as a quick, brief reintroduction, my name is Keith Redmond. I'm a former councillor for Fine Gael and Fingal, and I'm a dentist by profession, but we're not really going to talk too much about dentistry. And I'm joined by my beloved Sarah Ryan. Sarah?
I'm a much too young to feel this old. I'm a former councillor, work in business, worked in consulting.
For Fianna Fáil.
Sorry, I forgot that, yeah. That was an accident. For Fianna Fáil. And still work and take a very strong interest in politics, but I'm a little bit disillusioned at the moment. But yeah, and we come from very different backgrounds, so we like to argue about things.
We figured we may as well do this on a podcast because no one can hear us in our kitchen. So today we're going to...
Except our poor kids.
Yes, except for poor two little boys. So today we're going to talk about my hobby horse, which is... I'm going to start anyway talking about my hobby, which is the nanny state. And I think it would be fair to say that, you know, the nanny state became a real force when Fine Gael got back into government this time. Now, maybe in coincidence.
Okay, what is the nanny state, though? Okay, explain what you mean by that, because I think loads of people don't actually know.
I think you're right. I think a lot of people don't realise what the nanny state is. The nanny state, for example, is not the plastic bag tax, is what people always talk to me about. The nanny state is when the state says to adults that the thing that they're doing, which is affecting only them, that they're not allowed to do it, or that they're going to try to stop them or license them or temper them in some way. So an activity that you are eating, drinking, smoking, doing to yourself and yourself only, that the state has decided you're too silly to know what you're doing wrong, and they're going to take it on board. So the classic ones in recent times are kind of the sugar tax and fat taxes, which were tried in Denmark and failed. Sugar tax were tried in Mexico and failed.
Plain packaging on cigarettes.
Plain packaging on cigarettes. You know, cigarettes are bad for you, and so we're going to put a plain packet on it, and then you won't smoke. Silly, stupid things. And it comes down to this this great catchphrase in Yes Minister, you know, something must be done. This is something, therefore it must be done. It's not going to have any effect, but it looks like you're a busy minister. And as I was just about to say, the nanny state really had an uptick when Fine Gael came back into power after the crash. And I don't know if it was a coincidence. I don't know if this was just the time. I don't know if it was just the time of the nanny state. You can see these measures being introduced in other European countries. I don't know if it was just happened to be the time, but it really coincided with that. And we can see it now impacting threat. There was a very fervent Minister for Health at the time, James Riley, who's really big into nanny state measures. He's virulently anti-smoking, for example. And just to clarify, the smoking ban that was introduced famously by Micheál Martin
is not nanny state.
The only thing that he ever did. That is not a nanny state measure, because that smoking inside a building is affecting other people. So that's not a nanny state measure.
So you're not against the smoking ban?
Of course not. I support that. I think that's fine.
Because you hate smoke.
I do hate smoking, but at the same time, I think that if you want to smoke, you should be allowed to smoke if you're an adult. I mean, I don't have an issue with that at all, but I just don't think you should stand next to me blowing smoke in my face. But at the same time, outside, we're now moving to the next kind of frontier, because I know that now Senator Riley is eager to have the smoking ban extended to outdoor areas. So you're talking about the beer garden, you're talking about the tables outside the restaurant, you're talking about even in public stadiums, like football stadiums and stuff like that. So this is the next frontier, where smoking that doesn't affect anybody else, is not a public health concern to anybody else, is going to be banned. And that's the classic nanny state.
But is there anything, like, it's so kind of depressing, really, because it's like every time there's something good or something done that's, you know, effective, like the smoking ban was incredible, then there's this kind of like, what next, what next, what next, and how do we escalate this and escalate this and escalate this? Like, I'm a big fan of the smoking ban, but I also, from time to time, have a cigarette. And I resent the idea that if I want to go for a few drinks after work on a Friday and I want to stand outside having a cigarette, that I'm now not even going to be able to do that. Like, butt out.
Yeah, well, I mean, from my point of view, the smoking ban, the only issue I had with the smoking ban as it is that I think that there should be a provision that if you want to set up a smoking, you know, pub, a smoking bar, a smoking room, a cigar bar, or something like that, where people know that it's going to be a place we're going to smoke, I think you should be allowed to do that.
What about the staff?
Well, the staff don't have to work there. It's a new place. These will be new licenses for new places. You're going to work in a smoking bar. So, you know, you know from day one that this is a smoking bar. So I have no issue. I think that's the only issue I have with the smoking ban, that it didn't leave flexibility for adults to decide that they did want to have a cigar bar, for example, you know, and they just want to go there and smoke cigars and, you know, drink whiskey or whatever. But the point is that that's the only issue I have with the smoking ban as it is. But the new kind of departure, this new outdoor smoking ban, which is Senator Riley is proposing to bring to the Senate floor, which, as you just know, is going to sail through because everybody is so, you know, right on now, and they're all just going to vote for this nonsense. So, like, I think that, you know, that's the next thing that people are going to have to just wake up to, the fact that the nanny state is impinging on adults' freedoms more and more and more. We're going to get into it a little later, but I think that it starts off with prohibitions, for example, on alcohol that happened in the States in the 30s, prohibitions on drugs, which at the moment are still enforced throughout the Western world, but they're beginning to fall down. Prohibitions on cannabis, for example, and other things. So, but we can, like, it starts there, and people kind of go, well, I kind of support that. And then they go, well, we're going to make sure you can't buy a bottle of wine until after lunchtime on Sunday, because, you know, just in case you're an alcoholic and 11 o'clock on a Sunday morning, you need a bottle of wine.
And everybody, by the way, you know? I think the most, because I think you're a little bit militant about the nanny state stuff. I'm not 100% with you on the nanny state stuff. But I think that you're right in the sense that anybody listening who has a parent or an uncle or an aunt or whatever, who's an or a mother or father or whatever, who's an alcoholic or who smokes, knows full well that, like, their alcoholic dad not being able to get his cans until 11 o'clock on a Sunday or 12 o'clock on a Sunday instead of 11 isn't going to stop him. It doesn't make any difference. But, like, plain packaging doesn't stop people from smoking. Like,
just makes it easier for smugglers to make loads of cigarettes.
Exactly. And increasing the prices of cigarettes doesn't stop. Education stops people from smoking. You know, like, campaigns teaching kids that it's bad for you. Like, time and time again, these kind of campaigns work. But, like, increasing the prices of things and the minimum alcohol pricing and all, like, it doesn't actually do anything to tackle anything. It just makes everybody pat themselves on the back and feel better about themselves.
Well, it's politicians looking to be busy, to be doing, you know, seen to be doing something, but it doesn't actually do anything. I mean, as you say, it's a bit of a kind of a fixation for me. I've been the MC of the Nanny State Awards for the last 2 years, something we've held in Susie Street for the last 2 years, and it's been getting bigger and bigger, and it's really, I think it's great, actually. It's finally bringing to the public attention, the media attention, that not everybody's on board with this nonsense. You touched on the minimum alcohol pricing there, which was a function of the new alcohol bill which came through recently. Minimum unit pricing, just to let everybody know, effectively put a floor on the price that somebody could sell an alcoholic unit at. So, as you know, there's two alcoholic units in a pint. There's kind of one alcoholic unit, a small glass of wine, one in a measure of spirits, that kind of stuff. So when you factor that up to a bottle of vodka or a bottle of wine, they set a price, and nobody's allowed to sell it below that price. So it added an enormous cost to cheap alcohol.
Yeah, so not your shot enough to pop, but your cans.
Yeah, the politicians and the doctors who are advocating this, who are drinking shot enough to pop and Shabley, they're not being affected at all. But, you know, Joe and Jackie, who go down to Lidl and they get a few cans or a cheap bottle of wine, they're being really hit. So this was a real measure targeted specifically at poor people, and goes to the heart of what the nanny state's all about. It's wealthy do-gooders trying to make poor people live better, you know?
I'm not sure that's targeted at poor people.
Well, it is targeted. It only affects poor people. Let's be clear.
Do you think that the nanny state measures are a thought-out, actual, like, purposeful campaign by the government to do these things, or do you think that they're just measures that they think are great and they just go along, but they don't actually have a kind of a, like, there's not a nanny state agenda, there's just these measures?
I think that what happens is NGOs, which are generally funded by taxpayers, as you probably know, 5.5 billion euro a year of taxpayers' money is given to charities in this country, which are mostly NGOs and kind of charity industry types.
I live with you, so you bang on about this all the time.
So NGOs are set up for all kinds of things. I mean, you know, any kind of, you know, topic and you know, campaign you can imagine. One of them is Alcohol Action Ireland, which was this NGO that was set up. It's entirely funded, ironically, by the Department of Health. And its sole function was to lobby the Department of Health to pass the alcohol bill. So effectively, the Department of Health was lobbying itself to pass a bill that it wanted to pass anyway, but giving people loads of money. But the NGO went off and they send these researchers out and they come back with these ideas. And then the ideas are given to politicians and politicians think this is going to look really good on prime time. And then they run with them. So the idea of minimum unit pricing came out of research in the UK, research completely debunked at this point. But that doesn't matter because now it's a live thing in the political ether. And so people are now running with this minimum unit pricing. It was introduced in Scotland and the consumption of alcohol has gone through the roof in Scotland. But also the consumption of drugs has gone through the roof in Scotland. So specifically cannabis. So what's happened is people who used to drink a few cans on a Wednesday night are now not drinking cans. And what they're doing is they're smoking weed instead. So, you know, the whole thing is you cannot police adults' behavior because they will bend and flex to get around your policing. Because after all, it's their bodies and it's their choice. And we're all about choice these days, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean, listen, well, on this subject this week, there was this article about obesity being now reclassified as a disease. Yeah. And it is in that kind of, you know, in that neighborhood effectively where it's not your fault. You need to be parented. You don't understand like what you're doing to yourself. We will help you. We will tell you. And it's not your fault if you're obese or whatever. And I think that it is your fault if you're obese, to be perfectly honest. I don't think if I put on weight, it's not because some rogue ice cream truck got through the gates of our estate and drove around aimlessly forcing ice cream. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, it's just, it's part of a long, accidental or not campaign to reduce any sense of personal responsibility from people for anything that they do. It's not your fault. It's not your fault. It's because of Coca-Cola. It's because of this. It's because of that.
McDonald's.
It's because of McDonald's.
Yeah, McDonald's are making you fat. Yeah.
It's because of that. It's because of the other. And classifying obesity as a disease does exactly, you know, that. It takes all responsibility away from you. And I don't think it works. I don't think it will work. I don't think anything but education about these things works.
You see, but the point of it, I don't think, is for it to work. The point of classifying obesity as a disease means that, as you say to the individual, the tempting thing is, this is not your fault. You're fat, but this is not your fault. Would you like me to say this is not your fault? And they go, yeah, that'd be great. Who can we blame? Well, we could blame companies or we could blame advertising. And we could, oh yeah, let's blame them. That'd be great. And the reason that they do it is because if they say that it's a disease and it's not your fault, then they take the responsibility for it away from you. Once they take responsibility for something away from you, they also take your authority over it. They disempower you because you now need our help. And so the government then takes that power. They take that responsibility and then they start coming up with these intrusive nanny state measures where they say, well, you're not allowed to have this, you're not allowed to have that, we have to tax this, we have to tax that. And so it's a specific tactic that's used by nanny state politicians to take the power away from individuals and draw it into government.
Yeah, but that's fine, right? But you're a self-proclaimed libertarian. So you believe effectively, and correct me if I'm wrong, that everybody should be allowed to do whatever they want as long as they're not harming anybody else.
Yeah.
And that's fine, everybody being adults. Yeah. But you would consider it a nanny state measure, for example, or would you not, to put a chipper beside a school or a McDonald's beside a school?
That's nothing to do with that. I mean, I know some councils, including Fingal, when I was on it, that they tried to in fact, pass this ordinance where you weren't allowed to set up a fast food operator, McDonald's, chipper, whatever. I keep saying McDonald's, say Burger King, Kentucky Fried Chicken, whatever. Any of those fast food joints, you weren't allowed to set one up within 200 or 400 meters of a school. As if kids can't walk 400 meters. I mean, you know, and they're going to walk past all of this celery and hummus and they're, you know, they're not going to be tempted by that and they're going to go. I mean,
if a school has no money, do you think it would be appropriate for McDonald's to sponsor their school meals?
Well, I mean, I think that's down to the school board and the parents. And if they decided they need the money, they can do it. I mean, I don't think that having a hamburger, you know, is going to make you fat. I think that sitting on your ass is going to make you fat.
If our son was going to school every day and he was having a burger and fries for his lunch and a Coke every single day, we'll be fat.
Yeah, but that's down to parents to make sure you don't.
But you're not there. That's my question.
But why are you giving the government the power? I mean, parents are supposed to be responsible for this. This is exactly the point.
But
if you get
a... we're creating a kind of a hypothetical situation here. Although I do think that there's some parts of America where McDonald's actually do sponsor the school lunches. So, like... If you get a letter home, where our son isn't of school age yet, but he will be. If you get a letter home saying, we're now, the school lunches will now be provided by Burger King. Mm. You're going to go in and say, this is an outrage. We're not doing that.
Well, there's no obligation on him to eat it.
But he's five. Yeah, of course he's going
to
eat it.
No, but the point I'm going to get across to you is this. The whole point of nanny state politics is to take the power away from parents.
And
right?
I get that. And I get that. And I agree with you, like... a lot of the way, but I think that there are, I think that you are too black and white about it, and that there are exceptions. There are exceptions to the nanny state. Like, should the state make you wear a seatbelt? Yes.
No. Why should the state make you wear a seatbelt? It's only you hitting the windscreen.
Did you ever see that ad? If you go through the windscreen, you might hit somebody else.
Okay, I'll tell you what. The people in the back have to wear seatbelts. It's the guy in the back who did the damage.
Yeah.
The point I'm trying to cross is that was the perfect example, actually, of the state overreaching. Like, you had a guy holding a steering wheel who was going to hit a windscreen. Only he's going to suffer there. And yet they step in and go, well, now we're going to make it illegal for you to hit the windscreen.
No, but I get it. You're committed to your ideology. But, like, there is exceptions. So then should it not be illegal for me to not strap our two kids into the back?
No, I think that you'd be reckless, and I think that if you're reckless with other people, the state have a right to step in.
So then they should oblige me to strap in my under 18s.
But again, that's not the nanny state. You see, you're falling into the trap. I'm talking about that affects only you.
Okay, but I don't agree that if I don't wear my seatbelt, it affects only me. Affects only me is a concept. Like, you know, if I go through the windscreen and I hit somebody else, that can happen. That is affecting. Okay, you're laughing. But, like, it could happen.
I really don't think that happens that often. People go through windscreens and hit a projectile and hit someone else. Yeah. I don't think that's a thing. I really don't.
Okay, the person in the back comes through and hits the people in the front.
Okay, you see, you're stretching and fine. I'll give you that.
I'm not stretching. I'm saying there's four people in the car.
Yeah.
And one of them, like, we crash and one of them kills everybody.
Yeah, that ad was very powerful. I mean, yeah, fine. If you want to go there, the people in the back can't come forward and hit the people in the front. Fine. Whatever.
So the state is right to oblige them to wear seatbelts.
In the back, yeah.
In the back. Just say, ladies, there are some nanny state measures that make some sense.
No. You see, you're falling into the trap. This is not nanny state. You're falling into the trap
of becoming so consumed with your own ideology that you can't see past.
No, you see, this is why people say, I don't agree with the nanny state. I don't agree with your anti-nanny state because X, Y, and Z. And they're always not the nanny state that they're talking about. You affecting someone else, if we take this ridiculous example of somebody floating around in a car and hitting everybody else, that's not the nanny state, so it must be true. Yeah, true. That's not the nanny state. That's you hurting other people. That's not it, okay? What I'm saying is you doing something as an adult that affects only you, that the government has decided to start policing.
And Keith, like, I agree with you that I think that if I want to smoke, it's none of anybody else's business. Mm. I'm a social smoker, I suppose. I probably smoke 5 cigarettes a month, whatever. I go out for a few drinks, I might have a cigarette, but it's none of anybody's business. I'm well aware of what can and can't go wrong with cigarettes, and increasing the price of them by 50% doesn't affect that at all and won't. You know what I mean? I don't think that I shouldn't be able to get alcohol until midday on a Sunday. I don't think that the alcohol needs a special shutter so that people, when they can't see it anymore, will somehow kind of forget that alcohol exists. No, I agree with you on all of these things, but I think that you can be too militant about some of the stuff, and I'm just asking you about the seatbelt example because I think it's a good one.
Yeah, well, I think any measure that improves safety for other people as a result of your actions, I've no issue with. And that's why the smoking ban, for example, I've no problem with. And if you wanted to carry to absurdity, yeah, seatbelts in cars, fine, whatever. But if you are on your own doing nothing to anybody else and engaged in an activity with nobody else at risk, then I don't think the state needs to be there. The state is too busy trying to invade adults' lives to the point where they feel they have to be everywhere. And this comes also into discussion on drugs. And, you know, at the moment, we are beginning to finally have a conversation about how drug prohibition, has it worked? Is it helping? You know, is there a better way of doing it? And
well, this is one of the places where you and I disagree.
Yeah, well, that's good. I mean, like, for me, I think that drug prohibition, just like alcohol prohibition in America, hasn't worked. I mean, people still take drugs. Drugs are freely available. If you want to have drugs, you can get drugs. So prohibition has failed. I mean, there's no point in saying, oh, it worked and it helped a bit, or it's failed. Okay, you can get drugs wherever you want. If you want to get drugs, you can get them relatively easily, and people still.
So you don't think
drugs.
That there's anybody walking around the world or Ireland, let's just say, right now, who is 25 years of age who would have taken drugs if they had been legal, but hasn't because they are not?
No, I think if you're a 25-year-old and you're not rebellious enough to take something that's illegal, then you're a pretty poor 25-year-old. I mean, most 25-year-olds are rebellious.
Hold on a second now. Hold on a second. I didn't take any drugs.
That was because you didn't want to.
But like, well, so no, I smoked some stuff, but like, I didn't inhale. No, but I mean, I didn't take any like proper drugs.
No, hold on here. You just did something illegal, right?
I know, but right. I didn't. But I'm honestly saying that I think if it had been legal, and I didn't really do anything until I was in my 20s, but I think if it had been legal, I probably would have done it more.
Right. Are you telling me honestly that if heroin was illegal, you would have said, I'll have a bit of heroin?
That old trope now, Keith, where you just go to the most horrible, like, you know, why don't just crack as well? Like, throw
crack,
that in.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Yeah, but you've just gone to the most extreme drug.
But but that's the point. The point is that the fact that it's illegal
scale
didn't
it back
stop
a bit.
You.
Okay, so cocaine.
Right.
If cocaine was legal and you were able to go into a bar and you were able to just buy a line of cocaine.
You can. Yeah.
Okay, well, openly.
Okay, yeah.
Don't be a sap. Anyway, you're able to go up to a bar and say, can I please have a line of Colombian whatever. And they said, yes, that'll be €30 please. And you're able to buy it, and they handed it to you on, I don't know, what is it, a little...
Have you ever been to other countries where that is in fact the way it works? South America, for example.
I've been to South America, yeah.
Okay, and you would know then that, I mean, I've been there too. It is very openly available in bars at that stage. I mean, you literally people on the bar.
So I just have a pathological fear of ending up in a prison for the rest of my life. Yeah, so I never went near anything like that.
But that's okay. If you have a pathological and the criminality aspect of it worked for you, fine.
Yeah. I'm saying to you that if I was able to go into a bar on Dawson Street and ask for a line of cocaine for €30 or I don't know how much it is, and they were able to hand it over, whatever, it's much more possible or probable that I would have tried it.
Right. Well, I think that is a minority view. I think that the vast majority... I think from my experience, in my life's experience, I think that...
But that's because you're from Fingness and you guys don't break the law anyway.
Listen, the people in Balls Ridge are the ones selling it, right? So the point is that I think that the fact that something is illegal means very little to the vast majority of 20-year-olds. I think that most 20-year-olds are generally fairly rebellious. And, you know, the fact that something is illegal is not necessarily going to be an impediment. That has been proven by the fact that people take drugs. They're generally young people. They get it out of the system.
But you have no evidence. You have no proof that if 85% of people in their 20s dabble in drugs, will say, you have no proof that it wouldn't be 95% if it was legal. You have no evidence.
But what difference would that make? 10%? I mean, meanwhile, you've criminalised 85% of young people. And what kind of respect do you think they have for the law in general when you've criminalised them for doing nothing which is harming nobody except themselves? I mean, you can't have the state stepping in, trying to police adults, nanny adults, to the point where they're doing something which is affecting nobody but themselves. Because they just don't listen. They won't do it.
They won't
listen to you.
But I'm not sure that you can confidently say that drug taking does only affect the person that they're who's taken. I mean, like, children of drug addicts and like
alcoholics. Yeah,
yeah, but alcohol is legal. The horse is bolted there. You're talking about
but the horse
opening
is bolted
the
with
gate.
Drugs too.
Not necessarily. You can't fully prove that. You're talking.
I can prove it to you now by saying to you that 250,000 people in Ireland take drugs every weekend. So like.
You can't prove that it wouldn't be 350 if they were legal.
But what I'm trying to say is 250,000 already doing it. So your prohibition has failed. It hasn't worked.
The thing is, I think that what the issue is that I think that you're right to an extent, but I'm not comfortable with the collateral damage that come with drugs.
Okay.
So like what you say is if we open the gates tomorrow and we legalized all drugs, right? you must admit that there are some people, even just initially, who would take more drugs.
Okay. What has been shown...
Wasn't there some weekend where they accidentally forgot that drugs were legal for a weekend, and wasn't there some upsurge in
what actually happens,
people taking drugs because they weren't legal?
We don't need to get theoretical about it. What actually happens is, if you look at Portugal, they decriminalized rather than legalized, and there's a distinction there. You decriminalize something, it means somebody can buy a drug from somebody else, they don't get criminalized, but it's not actually regulated, it's not in shops, it's, you know, it's still kind of a bit of a...
So your entire argument about how you get rid of all the drug dealers when everything is gone?
No, exactly, which is why I wouldn't be in favour of decriminalising, I'd be in favour of legalising, but I'll get on to that. But the point is that when they decriminalised in Portugal, what they saw was initially there was an uptick of curiosity, and then it fell to a lower level than what the estimates were of normal drug taking. So people, the same number of people took drugs in the long term anyway. And people are always afraid, for example, well, let's legalise, if we legalise heroin, we're, you know, everybody's going to be a junkie. There's a line with certain drugs. The vast majority of people are never, never, never going to try heroin. Personally, I wouldn't actually make heroin openly available. I would put it on prescription.
Oh, wow. So you are interested.
No, but hold on. I'm a reasonable guy, Sarah.
Yeah.
So I would put it on prescription because the whole
put
issue...
Put it on prescription?
Yeah, put it on prescription.
Like what? Like what?
But we have it at the moment.
So I go
methadone.
Into my local GP.
But methadone.
I fancy a bang of heroin.
Methadone at the moment is on prescription.
But methadone
that specifically is.
Methadone is specifically for coming off heroin.
No, it's not. People are on methadone for years. They don't come off. That's a complete...
No, but that's the idea behind
No, it's really not the idea. You're completely wrong.
People start on methadone.
Let me show you. Let me show you people start... Yeah, some people do start on methadone. It's in their house. Yeah, they do.
So they go from smoking a few doobies and then they go, I think I'll try methadone.
Because
they go
there.
To their doctor and they get methadone.
Absolutely.
So, never happens.
What I'm saying to you is this. The whole idea is about... the term harm reduction. So we have a situation, we have a system now which has created an enormous harm. We've criminalized thousands of people. We've ruined their lives by putting them in prison. They can't go, they can't get visas to go places, they can't get jobs because we've criminalized them, okay?
I'll go a long ways with that.
And we also have a situation where we force these people to go to criminal gangs, pay them money, empower these criminal gangs who then engage in war throughout the city because the business is so lucrative. I mean, if you think about the head shops which were open there for a while, the people who were firebombing head shops were not anti-drug vigilantes. They were the local drug lord who was a bit pissed off that his customers were going to head shops. So the way to undermine drug lords and the way to win the war on drugs, if you like, is by legalizing and regulating it, and you destroy their revenue stream. All of these guys, the Hutches and the Kinnans and all these guys, you annihilate their business overnight. What happened to Capone when alcohol prohibition was legalized? All of the mafia dons who were living the high life were destroyed overnight because the market was gone. So the point is that...
He got arrested for tax evasion, though. He's obviously your idol.
Don't arrest a poor man for being a... You
know, common. Just a common, decent criminal.
That's civil disobedience. That's like Gandhi. But so the point I'm trying to get across is harm is caused by the current system. So how do we get to a system that has less harm? So do we criminalize all these young people? No, I think we don't. Do we force them into the hands of drug dealers? No, we don't. The other point is
safety. They all sound great, but your answer to these points is to just throw open the floodgates and like let the chips land as they may.
But the chips are going
to
be...
I think it's legitimate for people to be like, to think, especially people who've grown up like in situations where drugs has had an absolutely catastrophic effect on their life, to be afraid of that. And we're also talking about things like heroin or whatever. Like, there's loads of people, like, in the world, and two that I know, that I could mention, that I grew up with, who had massive mental health problems from just smoking hash.
Yeah, but, like, the mental health problems around cannabis, and there was a discussion recently by some doctors who came out and said, look, we need to talk about this. It was actually a reason to regulate and license and legalize, because... what they were talking about was skunk, which is a high potency artificial synthetic form of cannabis, which is made by drug dealers. Now, normal commoner garden natural cannabis, if you like, doesn't have the schizoid impact that skunk does. And even they had to admit that. The low concentration stuff that would... Anybody over 30 will be familiar with the stuff I'm talking about, hash and you know, low concentration cannabis. The new synthetic stuff, that's high potency and that causes those psychotic issues that you're talking about. But that's a reason to license and regulate, because in the States during alcohol prohibition, common hooch, if you like, was made by everybody and their mother. The potency of it was completely different. It could be different from week to week. People didn't know what to drink, didn't know whether methanol was in, alcohol was in. Exactly like drugs now. You don't know what it's mixed with, you don't know what concentrations are, whatever. And loads of people in the States used to die of alcohol and methanol poisoning, right? And just like we have now, people die of, you know, drug overdoses because they don't know what they're getting.
But what
abolishing prohibition in the States did was they mandated and regulated 4% beer. So it had to be 4% beer. So everybody knew that their beer was 4%. Everybody knew what they could and couldn't drink. And it meant that just like cannabis, you could regulate the concentrations. You could make it safer. You could reduce the harm.
But you talk about like the legalization of alcohol as if it's been some kind of wondrous, brilliant idea. Alcohol does nothing but cost the state, cost like rivers of tears, orphans, like alcoholism, abuse, like sexual abuse, like all kinds of things are a result of alcohol. So I would make the point that if we could go back in time, maybe we wouldn't legalize alcohol. Like, alcohol hasn't been some kind of roaring success.
Well, I'll remember that on Saturday when you asked me for a glass of wine.
Alcohol is legal.
But you're acting as if
legalizing alcohol was this great idea that turned out great.
But you're talking about it as if, you know, the state has the power to do these things. It's been proven time and time again. It's being proven today. The state does not have the power to stop adults from doing these things.
But the state doesn't have the power to stop people from murdering each other. But we still have rules about it. We still have laws.
It does stop me. I think it is a bit of a deterrent to be put in prison for the rest of your life. If you want to do that with drugs, they tried that in the States and it still hasn't worked. So again, it comes back to, are you hurting someone else or are you hurting yourself? If people perceive it that what I'm doing is only hurting or potentially hurting me, that they do reject the notion that the state has the right to step in.
I don't know. I'm not
going to. I think that it's been proven in Portugal. It's been proven in a lot of states in America that have decriminalized. That has proven the point. Your fears are unfounded, but they are fears that have to be accepted and discussed in public, because it is a natural fear people have. But they're unfounded. We've proven it. So I think that what we need to do is decriminalize and have an alcohol.
They're unfounded and we've proved it.
And regulate.
And let's just do what we did with alcohol because that turned out so well.
Yeah.
Go on, your next hobby horse there, prostitution. Let's throw that out in the stoop and see if the cat licks it up.
Well, if you like my drug talk, here's my one about prostitution. So the Sex Workers Alliance of Ireland are a fantastic organisation.
You should just like start, because every time you talk about this, it makes it sound like you love prostitution. Lay out your stall now. Okay. Lay it out well.
Okay. So first of all, I have a real thing, as you obviously realise, about the state coming in and telling adults what they can and can't do in the privacy of their own home.
What did your dad do to you when you were younger?
He instilled an independent verve. But the point is that it doesn't really get more personal or private than what you do in your bedroom. And the notion that the state will be at the bottom of your bed where consenting adults are engaged in some kind of sexual activity, I thought we had moved way beyond that. I mean, we got to the stage recently where we finally legalized gay marriage, which was the last kind of issue of equality when it came to
the government imposing their morality on people's bedrooms. Grand,
yeah, yeah,
okay.
I'm with you.
This is the point.
So we got to the stage where that was now legal. Okay, and we finally had equality where people in their own bedroom, whether you were Oscar Wilde being sent to prison, you know, riding your
Oscar Wilde had sex with children, though.
Yeah, well, I'm talking about what he was criminalized for and put in prison for. He was put in prison for having sex with a man. Okay, so. These were consenting adults. And I think that sex workers are consenting adults and I don't think they need to be minded by anybody. What they do is up to themselves. And that's the whole point. It should be up to themselves. And I think at the same time that we did it, it was extraordinary. So we decriminalized gay marriage, right? And on the same year, we further criminalized adults for having sex as long as they were being paid to do it. So it seems that this moralizing through our legislation is still not gone. That instinct is still there.
But what you... to see, the thing I have an issue with is this, with you, with this subject, is that you kind of act as if, like, prostitution is this kind of, like, you know, gorgeous-looking hot woman from New York who's putting herself through law school by being a high-class escort by night. But really, like, that's just some kind of romantic nonsense. And a lot of women who are forced into prostitution are forced into prostitution for economic reasons. They don't want to be prostituted.
What do you mean forced into? We're all forced into doing a job. I mean, I'm forced to go to my job.
Yeah, this isn't an... Okay.
You just have an issue about the job they do. That's the issue.
Yeah, I do, yeah. Right.
So it's nothing to do with being forced. Nobody's forced.
Well...
they choose.
Circumstances...
Yeah. Make you go to work, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, what's the difference?
It's anyway. Not forced. It's important.
Circumstances make them go to work as prostitutes.
And make us all go to work in our jobs.
Okay, but there are... do you not believe that there are people who are... like, you're acting as if... you're saying two consenting adults. But I question that concept. I think that one of those people is taking advantage of the circumstances of another.
Well, I mean, one is being paid and the other one's not.
Yeah, well, so what?
So the point is that if you're being taken advantage of by being given lots of money, I don't understand that concept.
Given lots of money. You're acting as if it's a standard job and it isn't. You're acting as... do you not think that there are women out there who are prostitutes who aren't enjoying it?
But I mean, who enjoys their job all the time?
Okay.
Like, you have an issue with what they're doing as a job. You don't have an issue with them going to work.
Yeah, because I think most of them probably don't want to do it. And I don't think... and I think that the men who go out and, like, pay for the services of these women, that there is a criminality in that. That they're taking advantage of a situation. And to your point about the drug dealers, that if we make something, like, illegal and they're not, those men can be prosecuted, then they can't go and, like, take advantage of these women. And these women will eventually have to go and get a different kind of job.
But why would you want... like a woman,
like,
who...
nobody wants their daughter to be a prostitute.
But hold on. But at the same time, if your daughter was a prostitute, would you want her going to prison? No. So, like, my point is that if you do agree that an adult should be allowed to decide, that they have free will, it should be given a choice over their own bodies. Okay, we're big into this. You know, women have a right to have power over their own bodies and a choice. It's their body, their choice. All this stuff. How come their body, their choice doesn't extend to having sex for money? I mean, their body, their choice is fine if they're having an abortion, but it's not if they're having sex for money.
Because you're blank, like, you're whitewashing over the word choice. How do you know it's their choice?
But how do you know it's not?
How do you know? Because I can... so you're telling me that you think that there's this swathe of women out there who lie in bed and, like, go, do you know what I actually want to do when I grow up? I think I want to be a prostitute.
You know,
I think I want to stand...
do you think there's a lot of them who say, I want to work on a cash register in a supermarket?
I think I want to stand... it's not the same, though.
Why isn't it
not
the same?
Because one's a lot more demeaning than the other.
No, hold on now. That's your value system, your morality.
Bullshit.
You're putting it on other people.
Bullshit.
You're putting it on other people. If somebody might be perfectly happy earning
two or
300 quid a day or an evening doing prostitution rather than sitting on a cash register of a supermarket for a week.
So you're telling me that you'd rather your daughter be a prostitute than a cash register?
Like, I'd rather she make her own decisions.
Oh my God, you're so full of shit.
Well, I don't want to... like, first of all, you can't... we've proven again, we do this notion where, like, you know, something must be done. This is something, so it must be done. And politicians pat themselves on the back. You actually can't police people's bedrooms. That's the bottom line. And so prostitution, I mean, they passed this law and nobody's been arrested for it yet because you can't actually police it.
But even saying like policing people's bedrooms makes it sound like some sort of Danielle Steele novel. Like, that's even happening in a bedroom. It's not. It's happening in a park bench or something.
No, it's not. You don't... like, the vast majority
go back to the girl putting herself through law school.
The vast majority of sex work in Ireland is carried out in apartment blocks around the city. That's basically it. I mean, in the city centre and the outskirts, you have sex workers who have apartments. That's it. I mean, they're... you know, this... you have this other alternative notion, this dark notion of women hanging around on street corners and laneways. That's also a Hollywood myth. I mean, that's not...
no, that's not true. I've seen prostitutes on the...
the vast majority of sex workers in Ireland are not hanging around on street corners.
Like, I don't know. I haven't been observing it that much lately, but definitely when I was a kid up around Leeson Street Bridge, there used to be prostitutes standing on street corners, and then, 100%, because we used to be rollerblading yes. there, and this woman used and to come on and go, "Girl, kids, you have to move on. The girls are working." And then, I remember it distinctly.
And then the internet happened. And so what happens with the internet is they don't have to do that anymore. Anyway, if you want to check out the Sex Workers Alliance of Ireland, SWAI, check them out on Facebook and Twitter.
And otherwise, and, just and have a long talk with your daughter about how this is not a career path and it's a terrible,
They will say that they spoke to the Minister for Justice before this and they asked her not to do it. And she said she wanted to send a message to society and she didn't care what the impact on them. So that was Frances Fitzgerald.
Right.
And she wasn't right. But we now have criminalization of people for having sex consensually. So I think we're coming to the end of this, our second podcast. And if you've enjoyed this little frisson between myself and Sarah, do join us for our third one. And I'd like to thank Rip Media for the opportunity to do all this. And this has been The Unsafe Space. Say goodbye, Sarah.
Bye.